Welcome to the Nonviolent Jesus Podcast. I'm John, Father John Deere, and today I'm speaking with my friend Jack Cohen Joppa. This is a project of www.beatitudecenter.org, where you can find many other podcasts and regular Zoom programs on the nonviolence of Jesus, practicing nonviolence, and working for a more just, more nonviolent world. So let's begin as usual with a little prayer. So I invite you, wherever you are, just to take a deep breath and to relax and to recenter yourself and enter into the presence of the God of peace who loves you infinitely and personally and everyone everywhere. And we welcome the nonviolent Jesus with us, and just take a moment to ask for whatever grace you need to be a peacemaker and do God's will. God of peace, thank you for all the blessings of life, love, and peace that you give us. Be with us as we reflect together on Jesus' call to be peacemakers and working for a more nonviolent, more just world. Bless us, inspire us, disarm us, strengthen us, and send us out to do your will, to do our part to help end war, poverty, racism, greed, injustice, and nuclear weapons and environmental destruction, that we might be your holy peacemakers, and welcome your reign of peace on earth. Amen. Well, it's a great blessing to welcome my friend Jack Cohen Joppa, who along with his wife Felice have published the Nuclear Resistor Newsletter, which is an amazing newspaper. They've published since 1980, over 200 issues now, which have chronicled basically every act of civil disobedience against war and nuclear weapons since 1980, which is that's over 100,000 anti-nuclear, anti-war civil disobedience arrests and prosecutions. And they've been encouraging all kinds of people across the country who've been jailed and imprisoned for these anti-war actions. Jack and Felice live in Tucson, Arizona, where they also work to educate the public on nuclear weapons, and they hold two monthly peace vigils outside the gates of both the Davis-Monthan Air Force Base and Raytheon, and they've been doing that for over 25 years. Jack's activism began in 1978 with the civil disobedience campaign at Rocky Flats, and he'll tell us about that. He continues to study, write, and speak publicly about nuclear weapons. From 1995 to 2005, Jack and Felice were the associate coordinators of the U.S. campaign to free Mordechai Vanunu, the great Israeli nuclear whistleblower. Since 2018, Jack has served on the steering committee of the International Coalition to Ban Uranium Weapons. And for those of us who have spent serious time in jail and prison for civil disobedience against nuclear weapons, Jack and Felice are our longtime faithful heroes. And I would really like to invite every listener to this podcast to check out their website and subscribe to their newsletter. It's at nuclearresistor.org or just Nuke Resistor, I think, N-U-K-E-Resistor.org. Jack Cohen Joppa, welcome to the Nonviolent Jesus Podcast.
Well, thanks, John, for inviting me on today.
So thanks so much, Jack, for your lifelong, steady, faithful commitment to promote all the grassroots work, especially, oddly enough, civil disobedience actions against nuclear weapons and war. Tell us all how you and Felice got into this work, especially with the famous action at Rocky Flats in 1978.
Well, I didn't meet Felice until 1980 when I moved to New Jersey, and I'll get to that in just a moment. But in 1978, I was a student at the University of Colorado in Boulder. I'd grown up in Colorado, and I knew that south of Boulder, there was a nuclear weapons factory called Rocky Flats, because one of the events of my childhood in 1969 was the largest industrial fire in the United States at Rocky Flats that sent plutonium-laden smoke into the air over metropolitan Denver. We were told not to eat the snow, etc. So that event planted in my mind that this was happening just south of the University of Colorado in Boulder. And I went on a junior year abroad program in England and read about the protests at Seabrook and at Weil, which were nuclear power plants under construction in the U.S. and in Germany, and the nonviolent direct action of the people who were opposed to that technology. And I was inspired. And when I got back to Colorado, I said, well, there's Rocky Flats. That's where I want to put my activist energy, because I've always been aware of what was going on politically around me growing up with the Vietnam War resistance and the civil rights movement on television and the fantastically inspiring nonviolent actions that were portrayed as I was growing up. And so this seemed totally appropriate to think about how do we draw attention to these nuclear weapons parts that are made right here where I grew up. And other people were already doing that organizing, I found out when I got home. And so I went to a training session in the spring of 78, two and a half day long training for nonviolent direct action to support what was planned as a major national demonstration outside of Rocky Flats in April of 78. So I joined all that organizing, and some people were planning to participate in a civil disobedience action. And I was still in college, and this was at the end of April, so I still had a couple finals coming up, and I just joined an affinity group to support other people who were going to engage in civil disobedience. And 5,000 people showed up for that demonstration, and at the end of it, about 40 over the fence to a nearby railroad spur and set up camp to symbolically blockade this rail line that served Rocky Flats exclusively. So it's like plugging it up a little bit to stop taking the waste out and bringing supplies in. So that night, a storm blew in, a spring snowstorm blew in, and the news had carried the demonstration that day. All, you know, all the media was covering it because it was 5,000 people, and among the people that were in attendance and speaking was the Pentagon Papers whistleblower Daniel Ellsberg. So that drew some attention, and he was one of the ones who went over the fence with the others to engage in the symbolic civil disobedience. And then a blizzard blew in. And I was there just to be present, supporting the people on the other side of the fence. And as the weather got worse and worse, people started coming in from Boulder and Denver, bringing blankets, sleeping bags, tents, hot food, and hot beverages to sustain the people who were engaged in this action spontaneously. And by the next morning, the blizzard had blown through, and the organizers came out to the tracks and said, okay, it's time to go home, because they had been in negotiation prior to the demonstration that this was to be just a symbolic civil disobedience action, then people would leave and go home. And if they got arrested, okay, and if not, they would just leave and go home. But after surviving the blizzard, the people on the tracks had spent the night huddled under a makeshift tent with plastic tarps and old railroad ties, telling each other's stories, and that included Daniel Ellsberg telling the stories of U.S. nuclear weapons policy and of his work secretly with the Rand Corporation and the Kennedy administration to talk about just how many people would be killed in a nuclear exchange with the Soviet Union. And he knew a lot about the command and control structure of nuclear weapons. And he told his stories that later became the core of his book, The Doomsday Machine, that was published about 6 years ago. He told those stories to these people sitting on the tracks. And by the time the morning came around and the organizers asked them to leave, they said, well, we are here in the right place. We are here at the right time, at the height of the Cold War. And we are here in the right manner, nonviolently, and we're going to stay. And so they did. And they stayed for a week until another blizzard came through, and finally the Jefferson County Sheriff's Department put deputies on an old boxcar and rolled it up slowly from the main line. And then all the deputies came pouring out of the boxcar to arrest the demonstrators who were on the tracks and carry them away through the snow. And they went and held a press conference the next day and said, we're going back to the tracks. And so I left my last two finals behind and went and joined them, and on Mother's Day joined an occupation of the tracks. And then that fall, several hundred people had been arrested repeatedly. Whenever a train had to go in or out of the plant, there were people on the tracks blocking the train's progress until they were arrested. And I was selected as one of 10 representative defendants for a trial, a representative trial in the Jefferson County Court, along with Dan Ellsberg and eight other co-defendants. And we had testifying on our behalf some of the top nuclear experts in the world, Dr. Alice Stewart, an epidemiologist from England who discovered that X-rays harm fetuses, and Dr. John Goffman, one of the co-discoverers of plutonium, who became a nuclear critic, Dr. Carl Morgan, who had established the science of health physics to understand the impact of radiation on human and other life. And they all testified on our behalf. The jury wasn't allowed to hear it, and the jury convicted us, but they did so, one of them in tears, saying, we wanted to support you because we heard what you had to say and why you were there. So that was my experience in 1978. And some friends went to jail, and I visited them in jail. And I'd already been corresponding with prisoners as, just part of my growing interest in our country and what happened, and seeing these people in the civil rights movement go to jail. And I thought, there are people going to jail for this anti-nuclear movement. And if our movement is going to succeed, we need to support those who have gone to jail and let people know about why they're there, spread their message to others, because they are inspiring to all of us. They're carrying a lot of water for our movements. And our movement can't succeed if we don't support them. And so that was the germ of the idea for what became the Nuclear Resistor Newsletter.
That's fantastic. Yeah.
Well, so then I moved. I had to get a better job to support this idea and kind of get correspondence going. I got a summer job in New Jersey, house painting. So I moved out to New Jersey. And I went to a demonstration in the spring of 1980, one of the largest anti-nuclear demonstrations prior to that big one in Central Park a couple of years later. I went to D.C. and joined an anti-nuclear demonstration and then signed up for a training on organizing for the anti-nuclear movement that was going to be in Philadelphia with the Movement for a New Society. And I signed up for that organizer's training through a New Jersey group, New Jersey SANE, which was a longtime anti-nuclear organization. And an intern in the office who was organizing the carpools down to this training session picked to go with me and a friend of hers in the car that I had. And we were driving down there. It was Felice and her friend Debbie. And we went to the workshops. And on the way back, Debbie and Felice start talking about Felice's upcoming 21st birthday. So just to make conversation, I said, oh, when's your birthday? And Felice said, oh, June 26th. And I said, oh, that's my birthday also.
And so the rest is history.
Yeah, and the rest is history. Like I pulled my driver's license out quickly so she wouldn't think it was just a really lame pickup line. And, the rest is history. She was, involved, and I was not involved, and we got involved.
So, Jack, I mean, 1980 was such a critical year as Reagan was coming in, and the threats of nuclear war and with the Soviet Union were so great, and there were tens of thousands of nuclear weapons. Meanwhile, the movement was really gearing up, from the Berrigans to the big march in New York City, which was the largest ever. And you started a Nuclear Resistor newspaper, which I've had pretty much ever since then, and I remember those days really, really well. So tell me about the first issue and your idea of this newspaper. You see it to the listeners, it's so shocking because there's just story after story after story. You just keep turning the pages. Okay, there were 20 arrested last week here, 20 here. And it's like a whole other world is happening out in the country that nobody knows about except for at the Nuclear Resistor. That's my take on it. It's amazing every time I look at it.
It was a serendipitous, sometimes in life, things happen, you're like, wow, this is the right place. I'm doing something that seems worthwhile doing. So with this realization that looking at history, that in any significant movement for social change, people have gone to jail for their activism, and that we had to support the activist who is in jail if the movement is to succeed, this idea to contact other organizations that were involved in this, growing anti-nuclear ferment in the United States and say, this is our idea, this is what we want to do. And so I began putting together, you know, a little newsletter to send out with that idea and how we might use this information, et cetera. And in the midst of preparing that and thinking about that, opened up a paper in September of 1980 in New Jersey. It must have been the Star Ledger. And there was a picture of these people in Pennsylvania who had broken into a General Electric plant in outside of Philadelphia, and they had walked into a room where the nose cones for thermonuclear warheads, you know, the nose cone that holds the warhead inside of the tip of the missile, were being constructed, this critical component for nuclear weapons. And the eight Catholic activists had walked into this room and started hammering on these nuclear weapons as a symbolic and real act of nuclear disarmament. And I thought, this is exactly why, you know, we've had this idea, you know, not that people were necessarily going to engage in, you know, property damage, but that people would take significant risks to pursue nuclear disarmament and a nuclear-free future. And here it happened. So that became the only story to report, like, okay, here we got a story. We're kind of ready to send this out to as many organization addresses as we had collected from the paper newsletters and from phone calls and from manuals that were published. This was all before the internet. And we sent out a couple hundred, you know, issues of like that. And just, I went down to Philadelphia for a support rally and met people who encouraged this idea that was just born with the first issue.
So that was the first Plowshares action.
That was the first Plowshares action.
With Daniel.
It happened to be the first, yes, Daniel and Philip Berrigan and Molly Rush and Ann Montgomery and Carl Cabot and Schuchard.
The first of over 100 now, and that was 1980. Yes. And as you know, in 1993, Phil and I and Bruce and Lynn, my friends, we did a Plowshares action in North Carolina, and I'll never forget, you know, we had many, many visitors and a lot of media attention, but you and Felice drove across the country from Tucson, and here we are in this dinky county jail in North Carolina, and I look like the Unabomber in chains, and you're allowed 20 minutes with us, and you came in smiling, both of you, and you just smiled, and you let us talk. I mean, it was such a profound lesson for me, because everybody who was coming to see us basically did all the talking, and we were stuck in jail. You knew what it was like. So I never forgot the kindness you showed me and what you taught me about there. What's it like to cover all those very serious civil disobedience actions over the decades, where so many people have walked onto military bases across the country, invoking the prophet Isaiah that God wants us to beat swords into plowshares, who actually symbolically but literally do that. And some have gone to prison for 20 years. I mean, I think it should be one of the greatest movements in history. There should be movies and TV series and Netflix about it.
Yes.
And, you know, speaking tours, and there should be thousands of these. And very few people know about it, and no one has covered it like you have. So tell me in general about covering the Plowshares movement.
Well, the Plowshares movement in particular stands out for its willingness to use hand tools and occasionally power tools to physically begin the act of disarmament. Humans, Molly Rush would say, humans built these weapons and humans can take them apart. And she witnessed that in her own life when she took a hammer to that nose cone in the Plowshares 8 action. So it's certainly inspiring and encouraging, you know, that we do have hope to see that this manifestation, even before the political will has been fully developed to disarm these weapons. It's been stated, non-proliferation treaty talks about we're going to disarm eventually all of them. But that's only been words. And here are people who are saying, no, it's time to take action. And so the physical tools used and the symbols used are an important part of the whole Plowshares movement. And one that's also, although it has drawn mostly Catholic and Christian activists, it has also drawn other people of peace who are not necessarily people of faith, because they've recognized that on a human level as well, this is what needs to happen. These weapons need to be taken apart. And yes, there is a risk involved in this way of approaching dismantling nuclear weapons, but there is a risk involved in allowing them to continue to be present in our world. And that's the risk of a nuclear holocaust. So that's the important part to me of the Plowshares movement. Yes, the broader movement of hundreds of, you know, tens of thousands of people arrested just crossing a line or occupying an office with a statement, blocking transportation routes. Those are all part and parcel of it, but there's a particular manifestation in the Plowshares movement that has been, that has been inspired by, when you consider historical precedents, you know, all the way back to the Diggers and the Levelers, but up to the present, the group in Great Britain, Palestine Action, whose activists have gone into arms factories associated with Israeli arms firms and exporting arms to Israel, and attacked the machinery and the computers intent to destroy them.
Yeah, I always thought that when you study the movements, and Howard Zinn would explain all this, that, you know, we need everybody in every walk of life to work to abolish slavery and war and now nuclear weapons and fossil fuels. But there's always a time where you need some frontline people who cross yes. the lines, good people breaking bad laws and accepting yes. the consequences. And even yes. in that, because you've, as you said, I mean, over 100,000 people you've documented who've gotten arrested for protesting nuclear weapons, to have a front line of them who are willing to give their lives, as some did 20 years in prison, yeah. because of this very beautiful symbolic act. And you could say, oh gosh, the things we heard in court, Jack, you know, from prosecutors and the audiences we faced. Oh, destruction of property, you can't do that. But, and that actually the Tea Party did that. Yes. Gandhi did that. Gandhi burned yes. the pass, you know, in South Africa. And that he yes. had the same charges I had. And Jesus turned over tables, not hurting anybody, killing anybody.
That's no violence at all. Point. That is a critical yeah. point.
And
me.
Dan would say, you know, do these weapons have a right to exist? No. And no. like, just as cremation ovens and gas chambers don't. I just want to say one other thing, you know, it was so inspiring. When I went to Auschwitz, I didn't know, but the women there realized what there was going on, and hundreds of them course. Stayed up and organized. And the next day they broke free and tried to, with their bare hands, bloody, take apart the bricks from the gas chamber. And yes. they were all shot. But I thought they were just saying, we're not going to be passive here.
Right. Right.
Can you say a word about any of the most, like some of our friends who did really long time in jail, and what your experience is covering people who spent time in jail and prison, you know, because that was what Gandhi was going through for revolution and overthrowing the empire. Here we're talking about nuclear abolition, and you've met all these people and visited many of them.
We have been fortunate to visit a lot of people, and one of the ways that we've been able to do this work is because we've traveled across the country on two cross-country road trips in the early 1980s. And then when we came to visit you, it was on our way for a family, you know, family trip as well, but we took advantage along the way. We visited Helen Woodson in prison in Florida. We visited you folks in North Carolina. I can't remember if we visited anybody else on that trip, but by meeting people and meeting their supporters around the country, the people who have been in jail and the people supporting them, it's helped us to be able to create the newsletter because we have a personal connection a lot of times with people. Now, mind you, after 45 years, many people have grown older and the movements have changed. But
yeah, so I want to talk about that too.
Yeah. That too. So we met Helen Woodson, who served some of the longest term in prison for the silo pruning hooks action, where she and Paul and Carl Cabot and Larry Cloud Morgan went out to a missile silo in Missouri with a pneumatic jackhammer, and they cut the gate on the compound and rolled the jackhammer up to the silo and started hammering away at the concrete cover of that nuclear missile silo. And she was sentenced to 18 years in prison, and she did that full time plus further time because she engaged in other actions when she first got out. And we'd met Helen Woodson in Madison, Wisconsin before our children were born. We were living in that right as the newsletter was getting started. We happened to have met Helen Woodson because she saw an early issue of the newsletter and said, well, this makes sense. And she had already met Phil and been to the Pentagon retreats with Jonah House. And she had... So when she did the action that ended up in her 18-year jail sentence, this is someone who we knew.
It's very powerful. Now, let me ask you.
And so yeah. we had to keep, you know, how could we walk away from this?
Jack, you, because of this work, because you have specifically recorded every protest that involved crossing a line legally against war and nuclear weapons across the country since 1980, for 46 years, you've seen all the local grassroots efforts, and then you've seen regional efforts, and then you've also had a sense, like maybe nobody else, of the national movement and how it's grown and then decreased, the ebbs and flows of it, and all the different kinds of national organizing. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about local and regional campaigns. So, for example, in Nevada, the Nevada Desert Experience, where we brought tens of thousands of people, Livermore Labs near Oakland, California, the Trident campaigns in Seattle and Connecticut and Georgia, and of course, the Pentagon, where people seem to be getting arrested every couple of weeks. And there are others. And people don't realize that. And even the movements and activists don't realize that we're all connected, and I wish we could somehow be connected, and your newsletter provides that.
Well, the movement against nuclear weapons and nuclear power has definitely evolved over the period of time that we've been, you know, chronicling these actions. But there have been a few significant campaigns that have somehow, through hard work and effort and good fortune, sustained themselves by their focus on a particular location that is critical to the nuclear weapons complex. And so you mentioned the Nevada Desert Experience in Las Vegas, which since around 1980, as long as we've been publishing, has coordinated nonviolent protests at the Nevada nuclear weapons test site, and in fact was instrumental in the public pressure that led to the cessation of nuclear weapons tests in the early 1990s at the Nevada test site. But the organization has continued, recognizing that the threat has not gone away. The test site is still kept on, like, you know, kept warm in case they want to continue or resume testing nuclear weapons, and they're doing other related nuclear weapons tests that just don't involve big bangs. And that has been a faith-based campaign started by a couple of Franciscans back in the late 70s and early 1980s, with support from religious communities around the country to maintain that presence there. Another significant campaign has been at the Ground Zero Center for Nonviolent Action in Washington State, where the United States has its nuclear submarine fleet, Trident submarines, based at the Kitsap-Bangor Naval Base. And immediately on the fence of the naval base is a piece of property that was purchased over 35 years ago by this community, the Ground Zero Center for Nonviolent Action. Its name says it all. And they sponsor annual protests and line crossings, blockades, civil disobedience at the nuclear submarine base on around Hiroshima and Nagasaki Day and around Martin Luther King's birthday holiday. And recently, just in May, at the Ground Zero Center, there was the dedication of a peace pagoda. The Nippon Zen Mohoji Buddhist Order has as its mission the promotion of nuclear disarmament around the world by the construction of peace pagodas and by chanting for peace in at demonstrations. And this, the community of monks there in Washington, at the invitation of the Ground Zero Center, it took decades of effort and surviving a lot of opposition locally, but now they have established and constructed a peace pagoda there, mm-hmm. right across the fence, within a stone's throw, even my old arm, a stone's throw from the fenced area where the nuclear weapons are stored for these Trident nuclear submarines. And this is an example that it's important. I think Dan Berrigan used to say, you know where you stand and stand there. And that's an example going on at the Ground Zero Center. And so at other places where that are critical to the nuclear establishment, the Vandenberg Air Force Base, there on the coast of California, just by where you are, there's a regular vigil and people are present when they do test launches of the Trident nuclear missile from Vandenberg. And there have been, you know, a series of civil disobedience actions and campaigns over the decades there at Vandenberg that are sustained now by a handful of activists that live in that area. And likewise, there's a constant presence every year at Livermore Nuclear Weapons Lab there in the Bay Area. And that's been going on since 1980, at least, if not before.
So I'm
these campaigns are links to a really dynamic movement past that we can only hope is somehow revised, resurrected in the present, because we face a nuclear threat, both nuclear weapons, nuclear power, and certainly the wars around them, that is certainly comparable to what we faced during the Cold War.
So as we begin to wrap it up, I want to ask you about that. I'm hoping this will broadcast in early August, as we commemorate August 6th, Hiroshima Day, and August 9th, Nagasaki Day. I wonder if you could say briefly a word about the real threat of nuclear war today and any signs of hope toward nuclear disarmament, which would really, I think, starts with the UN treaty to ban nuclear weapons, and I hope to be going to the meeting at the United Nations in November about that.
Yes, yes. Yeah, it's encouraging. I'm glad you'll be attending that first review conference of the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons that's going to be there in New York. Currently, 75 states have formally ratified this treaty, and another 25 are signatories. So that's the vast majority of the governments, the nations of the world, have signed on to the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons. But there is a lot of resistance from the NATO nations principally, as well as the other nuclear powers. And so our challenge as activists is to continue to delegitimize the idea of nuclear weapons and stigmatize them. Our job is to encourage financial institutions to divest from these companies. ICANN has just released their 2025 global nuclear spending report.
And ICANN.
They've documented, yeah, ICANN, the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, ICANW.org. And you can get their global nuclear spending report and see that in the last year alone, 24 to 25, global nuclear weapons spending increased by 20%, and in the United States alone spends more than all the other nations combined on nuclear weapons production. And $38 billion of that $119 billion, so that's like, what, a quarter of it, is profit for private companies. So the threat to us is as much from nuclear annihilation as it is from just the theft of human resources represented by this tremendous investment in weapons that, honestly, even the people wielding these weapons realize that they could never be used on the scale that they are preparing to use them, because there would be literally no tomorrow. What would tomorrow be worth? So that's what we're facing. That is the threat, not only that they would be used, but they will continue this theft of us. And so the treaty provides ways to look beyond that. The ICANN, the organization, has tools to encourage financial institutions to divest, as I was saying, and they work to encourage parliamentarians around the world to oppose it in their forums, so that nuclear states can never be insulated from discussion when they're in international forums, nations saying, but wait a minute, we also have this treaty that we all need to get behind if we are to have a future on the planet.
So, Jack, as I wrap up here, as thinking about you and Felice having chronicled the resistance to the nuclear weapons industry and the threat for 46 years, I was thinking at first, this must be the most discouraging thing in the world. But as I was studying your paper recently and your website, I thought, wow, there's so much going on. And I felt encouraged and full of hope. Is that your experience? Like, does this work? Is it
absolutely
demoralizing, or do you get hope that we can do this and abolish nuclear weapons?
It is no more challenging than the work of people who do direct aid to the least among us. That is frightening when I think about the people who take care of the folks I see hungry on the streets, driving around in Tucson. I'm not doing that every day. So nuclear weapons are no more traumatizing to me to think about. And then there is the hopefulness that I am in touch with the people who believe that hope is a verb and it's created by our actions. And if we don't take action, then we just as well give up, because nothing will change unless we do whatever small part we see that we can do. So I am encouraged when I read about these things.
What sustains you in this work and all these years and keeping alive the hope of the abolition of nuclear weapons?
I've been fortunate to have a loving family and have managed to have a good community of support here in Tucson. I celebrate creation by getting out in nature and stimulating my senses a little bit for joy, you know, at seeing what an amazing planet we live on. And that's what sustained me, and knowing that I'm part of a broad movement through history, and I've just kind of jumped in the stream to do what I can.
That's wonderful. As we end, I wonder if you have any last word of encouragement to our listeners to get involved in the movement or to stay involved, and also how can people get your newsletter?
Well, we would be happy to send you a free sample copy of the print newsletter. We offer subscriptions to 4 issues, which currently is about 2 years. That's another story of where the movement has gone and how much there is. But $25 for 4 issues, and we'll send them to you.
At the website?
First class in the mail. And you can also download them from the website a few weeks after they're published. You'll see it at nuclearresistor.org. And there's a subscribe link. You can subscribe if you would only like to get things online. That's where you can download current issues and past issues. But we do need financial support. We have been inspired by the Catholic worker movement pretty much all of our activist lives, and believe that this is work worth doing. And we've been fortunate to have just enough support to keep doing it. So we welcome that support as well.
Well, thank you so much, Jack Cohen-Joppa, for speaking with me today and all your beautiful work that you and Felice do to keep alive this hope. And thank you, friends, for listening to this episode of the Nonviolent Jesus podcast. You can hear more podcasts and find other upcoming Zoom programs at beatitudescenter.org. And there you can sign up to receive our free e-blast with news about other upcoming podcasts and Zooms. Please help us out by telling your friends and coworkers and church workers about the Nonviolent Jesus podcast. And please consider getting my new book, Universal Love, Surrendering to the God of Peace, which has all my latest reflections on this lifelong journey of peacemaking we're all on. If you're on Substack, look for me at Father John Deere. May the God of Peace bless you all. Keep on working for peace, resisting war, and pursuing the vision of a nuclear-free world. God bless you all.